This is Ben Clemmer. WBOI Presents In Session is a series where we hear from teachers, educators, and experts on all sorts of topics, sharing their lessons in the WBOI studios. As part of our commitment to lifelong learning, In Session gives us an opportunity to partner with those who have something to teach us. During this episode, we'll hear something a little different. In addition to hosting and producing for 89.1 WBOI, I also help to manage internship programs for our station. We have had a pair of interns in 2021 who got an opportunity to host their own episodes of this series. It's been a joy to work with these students. Callie Teitelbaum is a student at the University of Michigan, and she wanted to record a conversation with Aaron Kinzel, lecturer of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Michigan, on the topic of criminal justice. The conversation was recorded via Zoom. Thank you for listening.
Hi, Aaron. Thank you so much for being here today. How are you doing?
Great. Yourself, Callie. Thanks for having me on the show.
So we're going to be discussing criminal justice reform today and your experience in the prison system. So to start off, where are you currently now? Where are you working? And, you know, what have you been up to?
Sure. So I'm a professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. I teach a lot of classes surrounding jails, prisons, various elements of the carceral state, but also just criminal justice policy as a whole. I am also the executive director of the Youth Justice Fund, which is a small nonprofit out of Southeast Michigan. We serve individuals with direct services that are coming home from jail or prison that were sentenced as youth. So many of our clients, you know, went into the system 14, 15, 16 years old, which sounds kind of scary to think that we're, you know, sending teenagers off to adult jails and prisons, but it's a reality. So unfortunately, we don't have much, you know, decision-making process on people that are getting funneled in, but when they come home, we're able to help them find employment, educational opportunities, housing, and a big thing since I've come onto the nonprofit as executive director is trauma-informed care, which I think is a really big piece of reentry that is rarely used in society now. And it's definitely not something that's funded to allow people to get substance abuse services, you know, meet with clinicians who can help them really tie up loose ends from their past, not just their problems and trauma they had in prison, but like all the way back to early childhood trauma, which is a lot of the reasons why I myself ended up in the carceral state as a young man. And that doesn't excuse my behavior by any means. I want to make that very clear, but it just makes trauma and inequality and growing up in violent and really, you know, marginalized communities, it just makes it so much easier to get wrapped up into really bad decision-making processes and end up getting a part of the whole system.
You have personal ties to the prison system that started from a very young age. What was your experience with the prison system?
So, I mean, that's almost like 35 years back. My youngest memories of it as it was a little boy watching different men that my mother was with going in and out of the prison system. I watched, I don't know how many people get out on parole. I even went to prisons as a little boy with my mama to visit people. My father, who I never met, was in and out of prison. He may still be in prison now. My mother really refuses to tell me exactly what's going on with him. So, you know, decades ago, my first contact with the prison system as a little boy, which is really terrible to kind of think how incarceration is often familial, and it's a cycle. It's a disease that's kind of passed down to the next generation very often. So as I'm watching, you know, different men in my mother's life, my mom was in institutions as a juvenile. Eventually, I become a juvenile delinquent, start doing things that I shouldn't be doing in my community. It started off very small, but by the time I was 15 years old, I get incarcerated in a juvenile facility, which again led to more and more infractions. I started selling drugs like my parents were, getting involved in bigger and bigger crimes. And eventually I got into a violent confrontation with law enforcement at the age of 18, which earned me a 19-year prison sentence. And I was fortunate enough to only have to do half of that time, but it's kind of crazy for an 18-year-old kid to like realize that like I'm facing life in prison for what I did. And I want to be very clear. I have a lot of remorse for what I did. Like I, you know, took a shot at a police officer during a traffic stop, which is not okay. I was a wacko kid and they returned fire at me. It was this big shootout. But I can't take back what I did as a kid. You know, I grew up hyper-masculine, aggressive, and I responded with everything through violence because that's what I seen my community do. That's what I saw my family do. Again, that doesn't take away my accountability for that act, but it just shows how some people grow up in a way that this adversarial relationship with police is normalized. It's this us versus them mentality. The government is really out to get you. They're not really in a place to help you and your community when you're struggling. So it becomes this sometimes violent confrontation. So prison is not fun, Callie. I don't know how else to say it, but I will say this, like there are certainly positive elements that came out of my carceral experiences. The negative parts, obviously spending time in solitary confinement was very destructive to my psyche as a young man, very damaging psychologically. And I still have nightmares to this day and dreams where I'm, you know, living or reliving those events and flashbacks. But the positive elements that came out was that men that committed very serious acts of violence, a lot of whom will never get out or they're serving life terms in prison, became my mentors and taught me about the role of giving to my community, being a community leader, the value of education, educating myself while inside, being read, and just finding ways to really de-escalate violent situations. Many of them told me that violence is only an answer under two circumstances, which are someone is eminently going to harm you or someone you love. And I kind of like hold true to that to this day. Like of all the violent stuff I did in my past, like the only thing that would really make a lot of that darkness come back out of me is like someone tried to physically harm me or my child, for example. So you know, there's some good people in prison that did some really bad things. And I think with age, and there's criminological research on this, where they age out of crime in their older years, when the brain becomes fully developed in our mid-20s, the prefrontal cortex is solidified. We're able to have a forethought. We're not so impulsive. This was so very much the case with me as a young man. Like I was a really mean kid and angry at the world. But in my mid-20s, parts of my brain changed. And my maturity level changed. And I started realizing that I needed to prepare for my release. And prison education really was like my saving factor, which kind of led to my reentry process, which has made me very successful since I've come home.
I'm Callie Teitelbaum. Our guest today is Aaron Kinzel. And this is Criminal Justice Lesson One. So, Aaron, you talked a lot about how you got involved in the prison system and part of your experience once you were there. When you were in prison and serving your time, you mentioned mentors that you had, an element of remorse you felt. What was that experience? What was going through your head day to day for years?
I guess I'll try to like explain that linear wise. Like, so in the beginning, I think I had a very bad attitude. I really felt like, you know, I was given a bad situation. Like I got over sentenced, like all this, you know, it's all, I'm not the problem. The system's the problem, you know, and I blame my mother and a lot of other people in my life that I grew up with saying, you know, like they put me in these types of environments, which certainly did help shape me and make me more aggressive and violent. But like, I wasn't accountable. Yeah, in my early years. So that's a big problem that I struggle with, trying to like encourage others to really embrace accountability and understand, you know, that they have done something wrong and they have to own it. So again, I think that was connected to my psychological development. As an 18-year-old kid, I wasn't ready cognitively or maturity-wise to really embrace and understand what the hell it is I did fully. Doesn't mean I didn't know what I did, but I just didn't fully grasp everything that occurred and why it occurred and stuff like that. So in the beginning, it was really rough. I was fighting a lot, very aggressive with other prisoners. But again, as I started getting to the mid-20s, these other prisoners that were serving life sentences, you know, really embraced me and gave me books. They gave me different really interesting pieces of literature and said, Aaron, you're a smart kid. You know, you should really read and really explore things. And they also taught me about law and public policy and how to fight my criminal case and also do civil legal actions. And, you know, it's really weirdly enough, it's like these men were like professors to me. You know, these were faculty members that jailhouse lawyers or people that were very well read and didn't have degrees, But these were men that were very smart and taught themselves, and also peer-to-peer education, because like generations before, it helped teach them. And many of them would challenge me and say, you know, Aaron, what you did was unacceptable. And I was just like, what? What do you mean? Like, you killed somebody, bro. Why are you trying to tell me that, like, I got close to doing something like that? But that's really hypocritical. If you say that, they said, yeah, we know what we did was wrong. And we understand it. But we're trying to tell you is that you don't understand what you did was wrong. And that was really like an eye opener for me, I think, to really understand that these are men that, you know, were accountable for their actions and had remorse, but they also wanted to give back to society. Many of them knew they'll never get out of prison, but they had an opportunity with me and others to help shape me, because they knew I had an out date. Like, you know, how am I going to come out of the system? Am I going to come out more bitter and angry? And of course, that's going to lead to more criminality and probably a bigger case where I may take someone's life or my life might be taken and just destroy my community more. Or am I going to really own what I did and find ways to improve upon myself and my community upon it? So it was a really unique transformative experience in between a lot of the BS that I went through inside, proving myself, you know, through violent acts and stuff like that when I was younger, when I thought that was necessary, because prisons are a very hyper masculine, aggressive environment. That's very true. But there are elements of stability and calm there if you know how to navigate it properly and you just stay out of all the drama. It's really the young kids like me in the system that are just disrupting everything, you know, the ones stabbing people and causing fights all the time. The middle-aged prisoners or the older prisoners, more often than not, are just laid back and just trying to do their time because they realize that, you know, everything in their future is going to be in this 6x9 cell. So they have to like live the best life they can in these, you know, kind of like terrible environmental.
So how has your personal experience shaped your beliefs about the criminal justice system as an adult?
I think my earliest memories of understanding of the system, like I said, a lot of men were coming out of the system with my mama that were on parole. They were real violent guys, really bad. And none of them wanted to learn their lesson. They were people that I would call doing life on the installment plan. They would come in for a couple of years, get out, do more crimes, get back in, violate parole. And I knew that these were broken people. But at that time as a child, I really didn't understand how being broken and trauma and all these different environmental impacts really affect an individual human being. So in my earliest years, I think I hated people from prison. And I think I hated them more than the system and the police. Like, it was just like, these are bad people doing bad things. But then as I started like doing these things myself with criminality, I think my ideas started to change. Like, you know, I started to realize rudimentally, like, there are reasons why people commit crime. There are people that do drugs more often because not because they want to get high, because they're trying to mask or numb the pain of some traumatic event that happened either on one occasion or multiple occasions throughout their life course. So addiction, as we call it, you know, it's just people are self-medicating. So that becomes an issue. This whole war on drugs is a war on humanity and you know, people's like mindset of dealing with really crazy stuff in their lives. As I just started to transition out, some guys were teaching me, like I said, law and policy. But then as I came home and went to undergrad and the University of Michigan, and my master's degree was in public administration and policy. So then I really started getting my feet wet in the scholarship and the theoretical components of politics and policy and organizing. And then I started lobbying different legislative bodies and different elected officials and working with other justice impacted individuals who are doing the same thing as me. So now I'm like a part of the process of the change, which was really weird. And I never expected that in my entire life. So a lot of my colleagues, I think, are still very anti-system. They have this abolitionist lens to where they think we need to wipe out the entire system completely. I don't necessarily agree with that perspective wholly. I think we need a dramatic reformation of the system. And there are elements where we don't treat people like human beings and they're pushed away. But there are some people that are so dangerous, Callie, that they can't be let out of prison. I'm sorry. And there's not an end date to where they'll ever be safe. But we still need to treat them like human beings while they're in custody. So that's a big thing. But some of my colleagues think, you know, let's just let everybody out. That's not how I feel. But what I think another shift in my perspective has been working with people. Like, I work part-time at the Washtenaw County Sheriff's Office. They know what the hell I did. You know, I got into a violent shootout with two state troopers, and I've proven myself so much through my professional development and my academic credentials and all this stuff. Like, they trust me enough now. Like, I'm working part-time for a sheriff's office. I know a couple county sheriffs in the state of Michigan that I can call. I have their personal cell phone number. My boss at the University of Michigan is a former judge. I've done contract work with former directors of the Michigan Department of Corrections, like in the federal system. I just went yesterday to the Bureau of Prisons facility in Milan to give a keynote speech for high school graduation for guys that got their phone. I'm not saying all that to brag, but what I'm trying to say is that I'm in a totally different level of understanding of these systems now. Like, I'm dealing with really high level administrative officials in various pieces of the criminal justice system. So now I think instead of seeing this whole black-white divide to where, you know, I have this one perspective, they have another perspective, I've got a real dual perspective, very centrist position, I believe, understanding what it's like for someone like myself to be subjected to these experiences in the system, being justice involved, but also now being trained academically and working with these professionals in these spaces. It's given me really deep insight, and I think, honestly, a lot of these people in the system, criminal justice, want to do the right thing. It's just we have some people in the system that are just not on the right page. It's kind of like prison, I think. There's people that are locked up that I think are good people. There's other people that are locked up that I think are terrible people that never need to come home. So we've really got to really differentiate between the good and the bad and people that are justice involved and people that run these systems and come together collectively to really find ways of dramatic reformation system. I think that's the only way that we'll really have any success in life is to look at both sides of the coin.
And you touched a lot on misconceptions about the criminal justice system, advocacy, performative activism, and I want to dive into all of that. First, I want to talk about kind of what you mentioned about colleagues who are on different pages than you in terms of abolishing the prison system. And abolishing the prison industrial complex is a buzz phrase that I think is heard a lot nowadays. So what does that mean?
So, I mean, honestly, it's really depends on who you ask, Callie. That's one problem I have with these buzzwords is that, like, we hear ACAT or abolish the police or abolish prisons. It really depends on the individual. I mean, it can mean dramatically different things. I've heard some people say that, you know, abolish the police means to restructure it and to get more social workers in there or more people that don't have guns. I'm like, well, that doesn't really mean abolish to me. Abolish to me is a literal phrase, meaning like we just remove it. You know, we take it completely away. Now, from my perspective, for a dramatic reformation, it does mean that we wipe out the entire system. We just dramatically change components of it. And we put new people in positions of power. Like I was touching on, you know, earlier, like a diverse set of individuals with different experiences and professional backgrounds to come into this system, utilize the structure of the existing system, because to be very realistic, you cannot destroy a system that is this powerful. This is a multi-trillion dollar industry that has deep connections to everything. I do have a problem with the prison industrial complex as a whole. And what does that mean? That means that the system as we know it now is deeply embedded into corporate interests. And that's the problem with, you know, the criminal justice system is that these corporations through campaign contributions and the exploitation of labor of people that are incarcerated, the politicians now have an interest to build the system to be more punitive, larger. We always want a bigger system. If you look historically, early 70s, we had, you know, a couple hundred thousand people incarcerated. 50 some years later, here we are, we have more than 2 million people incarcerated in jails and prisons and detention facilities across the United States. There has been some pushback from some communities with the war on drugs and stuff to where they wanted to have more police presence because there's so much violence. And I don't think we even equate that to, like, you know, the war on drugs is very violent in nature. And that's not just from the carceral state or state sanctioned violence on communities. That's communities where, you know, there are warring factions between people that are selling narcotics. And selling narcotics in itself is a violent act. Like, if you give someone heroin and they're strung out on drugs or they overdose and die, to me, that's a violent act. So the carceral state is profiting off this. They have all these industries inside the system, you know, like potato fields. A big one was like Victoria's Secret lingerie back in the day, Starbucks. All these industries that you would never think about, you know, are being made in prison. Some of them have pulled out of the system now because they've been kind of put on blast. But like that, we should abolish that piece of the system. The industrial complex component should be abolished 100%. I think there should be opportunities for people to be trained inside prisons and get work experience, they should be given some type of compensation that's fair and maybe time off their sentence, but like they shouldn't be given pennies on the dollar to utilize the slave labor. Every corporation in the North and South and even overseas utilizes prison labor. So that part needs to go. But for the rest of it, Callie, I just don't see how, you know, I don't want someone that has no regard for human life. I don't want them out on the streets, to be very frank. You know, to me, that's not a trauma issue. That's a lack of empathy. And just there are some people that are biologically have issues to where they don't want to change and they have no care or mindset to harm other individuals and they will not stop. You let them out, they're going to wreak havoc. I think that's a smaller piece of the population, but it's still a recognizable portion of that population. Why would we put the liberty and the safety of the masses at risk when we've already have someone that's proven themselves to be very consistently violent and do damage on society? Why would we let them out for their individual liberty interest when we're putting society, a population's liberty and safety at risk? It just makes no sense to me. But I think even in some cases of violence, myself included, like I committed a violent act, I think there are opportunities where people can change that. I think that is more often than not. When you take people out of violent circumstances, you retrain them and give them opportunities, I think violence is a learned behavior more often than not. But there are some people that it's beyond a learned behavior. It's a mental illness. There is a biological deficiency to where, to them, raping and killing is okay, weirdly enough. And there are people in society like that that can't be changed. So discerning between those two, the people that we're mad at as opposed to the people we should be really afraid of, that's a big part of deconstructing mass incarceration in this country. You know, some of the other lower level drug offenses, some property crimes, different thefts and smaller things, like we could really deal with these restorative practices in the community and find ways to just help people get an education and get employed to where they're not going to have to resort to this petty level crime in order to survive and support their families.
You touched on a lot of key elements within the debate and conversations about criminal justice reform, that being the role of corporations, this modern day slavery that is being seen, and a lot of literature on that. There's the new Jim Crow, the second founding, you know, the 13th Amendment, and how that's been redeveloped into the prison system, low wages. And you also come from a background in which you were in prison and you committed violence and you served your time. With all that in mind, what would you say is the most common misconception about the prison system that you hear in public dialogue?
I think it's just that everybody inside is a psychopath and dangerous. Like, I mean, people that come home, and myself included, even in the beginning, like, you know, I have multiple felonies. I'm a felon for the rest of my life. You know, I'm going to have my doctoral degree here soon. I'm a professor. I'm a father. I'm all these other professional things, you know, and a good civically engaged citizen, but the 9 things that are good about me are at the end of my name. Okay. The first thing really is like the felon, you know, prefix to my name. Like that's never going to go away my entire life. So fortunately for me, my other things that I've done have started to like wash away that, not really wash it away, but it's just people are now, I think, more accepting of me because I've done so many other positive things. They know I'm a felon. They know I have a criminal history, but now it's a part of my identity that is like acceptable per se. But the average individual that comes home, I think the misconception is that they're all dangerous, that they're all violent psychopaths, that everybody that comes home is a Ted Bundy and keep your kids away and nobody is safe from the dangerous felons. And let's not give them jobs. Let's not give them opportunities. Let's not let them in school. Many universities, places across the state, they have all kinds of very discriminatory rules and regulations that preclude individuals from attending college because they have a criminal history. They let people in sometimes, and there's a racial component to this as well. Like very often I see people excluded more often because they're a felon is problem one for these universities. B, they're a person of color too. 3, they're impoverished. The more of those check boxes you make, the less likely it is for you to get into an academic institution. And that's not okay at all. So I think that's the biggest misconception. Like I have people I work with at the Youth Justice Fund. You met some of them, I think, Callie. You know, some of them have committed very serious acts of violence. But this was 30 years ago, 20 years ago. These people have evolved since then. And that doesn't mean all of them, but a majority of my clients are accountable for their behavior. They want to do well, but they're just not given an opportunity because they're demonized and stigmatized in our society and our culture. So until that starts to change, I don't think we're ever going to change the criminal justice system, because before it becomes a policy change, it has to become a cultural understanding of these individuals. And we have to accept them and realize that, you know, they're a big part of society. There's estimates that say anywhere between 70 to 100 million people in this country have some type of criminal justice record. And that doesn't mean everybody's been to prison. That means people have arrest, jail, juvenile detention. You've got something. And then if you go to like how many people have a family member, that's more than half the population of this country that has had contact with the system. So there's a lot more of us out there than I think society realizes, but we often create this, just like in politics, this us versus them mindset. People that have been in prison, more often than not, are very similar to people that are on the streets. A lot of people did stuff on the streets, just never got caught. Maybe not as serious as some of the people that got locked up in the prison, or they've had resources and able to get them out of court proceedings. You know, that's a very common occurrence. You don't see rich people in prison. I'm sorry. Does it happen on occasion? Yes. Martha Stewart got locked up. That was just a slap on the wrist. Like, if I was to do that, I would have probably got like 20 years in the federal system or something like that, because I don't have the financial resources to get, you know, seven lawyers that cost me $500,000 or more. So it's all about equality and the disparities that we have, not just in the system, but in society.
You mentioned the financial component with inequalities in the criminal justice system and the element of race. There's so many social issues that are tied to the criminal justice system: race, economic inequality, policing. In terms of where their needs work, where would you start?
I think one of the biggest problems we have is the cash bail system. That's like the kind of funnel into the criminal justice system. That's the gateway, per se. So law enforcement picks you up. They have a perceived, you know, idea that, you know, you committed a crime, but then they turn that over to lock you up first. Let's be very linear here. They think you committed a crime, they just lock you up. So unless you have bail money in the process, which is, you know, sometimes, you know, a few thousand dollars, sometimes it's, you know, $500,000. We are putting cash amounts on individuals' lives without, there's supposed to be a preconceived notion that, you know, you are innocent until proven guilty in this country. And yet we do exactly the opposite in our criminal justice process. We lock you up and say, all right, well, sorry. The only time someone should be incarcerated in jail for a perceived crime is if there is substantial evidence, and this is in like law books too, like, are they a threat to society, an imminent threat to society? Are they a flight risk? You know, and did they commit like a more serious crime, like someone that's like being charged with murder and there's evidence that shows that they committed a murder and they're a flight risk and more harm can be done? Yeah, we should lock that person up, but we shouldn't put a dollar amount on whether or not that individual should be released. So if someone that's poor that allegedly commits a murder, if you put them there for $50,000 bond or $100,000 bond, they're probably not going to be able to get out. But someone that is more affluent and wealthy or has a home or the cash in a bank account to put up 50 grand or 100 grand, why should we let them out if the act is exactly the same? That's dramatically unequal in this country. And I feel it's like very discriminatory, but we allow it to happen. It happens in every district and every state across the United States of America. Other countries laugh at us. My daughter lives in France and I've worked with professionals in the European criminal justice system. And when I tell them stories, they've read about stuff, obviously, as scholars. But when I tell them like these stories of how people have felonies and they never get rid of their record, they get held in jail for 3 years without actually having a trial, they laugh. They just can't believe it. It's so absurd to them that, you know, that would never happen in some European countries and other places around the world. So I think that's probably one of the biggest ones, because that's the driving factor of prison expansion too, is like you get people in jail, they sit there for a long time. The longer they sit, the prosecutor forces plea bargains on people. 95% of people in this country, their cases are dispositioned through the plea bargaining process, which is insane, which basically means that no one utilizes their constitutional right to go to trial. And all that is connected to the cash bail system, to where you're forced in a setting in jail. If you're sitting in jail, even for a couple months, you lose your job. You know, imagine being there 2 or 3 years, disconnected from your family. You have nothing. So of course people are going to plead guilty and say, all right, well, I'm going to get 2 to 3 years for this instead of me facing 20 to 30 years, you know, at trial, like myself in my situation. You know, they tried to offer me a lower plea bargain deal. I think it was effectively 9 years at one point. And I pushed back and said, I'm not doing 9 years. That's insane. I don't feel like my action was that serious. And like, it didn't meet the statutory qualification from law. So I fought my case and went to trial. Guess what happened? I lost. They doubled my sentence. So I didn't get 9 years. Now they gave me 19. And that happens every day in the criminal justice. We punish people for exercising a constitutional right. We sit them in jails, no bail. And if they go before a court eventually and they dare fight the system for a trial, they get punished double or triple the normal sentencing guidelines. It's like punishment upon punishment. And then when you get released, there's another punishment because you're a felon for the rest of your life. It never goes away.
In terms of cash bail, reform with cash bail, the role of corporations, is there a path to change right now politically through legislation? Where do we stand now?
So there is a movement nationally on getting rid of cash bail. There are some municipalities and counties that have taken this approach. Washtenaw County has taken that approach. They're not exactly implementing it the way they said, but the prosecutor there has mentioned he would stop cash bail, but on a couple incidents, he's allowed it, which I think is hypocritical, but it's a whole other conversation. But abolishment for something like that, I think, is appropriate because that has a deep inequity. I think it is important that you have activism in this country and protests. The problem with a lot of these protests is, and these hashtags and these buzzwords, is that there's no unifying message connected to this. So we need protests. We need this activism to gain attention of not just politicians and government officials, but society as a whole. We need to gain the attention of the masses. That is important. But where I think a lot of these protests and this activism fails is that there's no solidified backbone to this activism where people are actually educated policy experts that say, all right, here's the solution. We've got your attention now on YouTube and there's been a million likes and everybody's watching. There's no political ask. There's no policy change. We're not offering up a very solidified solution to these problems. We're saying this is bad. Just wipe it out. That's why I really hate the abolishment context of prison. Like, you can't just let out 2 million people. You know, you can't just lock people up and say you're good because the majority of them will come home at some point. So the question becomes, who do you want your neighbor to be in the future? Do you want someone who's pissed off and angry like I was when I first got locked up as a kid? And it wasn't the system that changed me. It was people within the system, you know, that really emboldened me and empowered me to do better upon release. So we have the political capacity to do this. I just don't think we have the leadership to really force this conversation.
Why should people fight for these changes? And what would you want the public to know about the formerly incarcerated community? And why do they deserve rehabilitation?
So why should people fight for these changes? I think because we really need a fair and equitable society. In America, we often say we're the land of the free and that we're all about opportunity. No, we really are not necessarily the most equitable side. I think we certainly are more than a lot of other countries and other parts of the world. But like, we can do so much better. Again, if you have people like, I use myself as an example, again, not to fluff myself, but to say, look, okay, I was around the craziest stuff, really bad environment. I lived in the projects as a little boy. And then I went out into rural country. Lots of crime in both areas and violence. But like, and in prison, if I can go through all that, come out on the other end, educate myself, become a professional and do well, so many other people have that same capacity. So it's just a matter of opportunity and chance. When the stars aligned, I got to where I can be. So the question becomes now, as a society, who do we want to come home as citizens? You know, do we want people like me that may have done some violent acts and really been bad citizens in my youth? But now do we want people to transform? And if we don't add rehabilitative elements to the criminal justice system, which by, I will say, like, are much cheaper options than just full incarceration, giving people access to Pell Grants, which was recently done through Congress back in the correctional facilities nationwide, the Pell Grant expansion will happen in 2023, which got taken out in 1994 by the Clinton administration as a real tough on crime perspective. Like, why should these prisoners get an education? I'll tell you why they should get an education for two reasons. A is transformative, and will change people's lives and allow them to like really be civically engaged citizens upon their release. B, education in carceral settings has the highest rates of reduction in recidivism of any program that's ever been offered in the United States. Upwards of 43% reduction just by having a couple classes inside. And I would fall under that. So my recidivism rate upon release was 43% less than someone that was in prison that didn't have a college experience. That's just real simple numbers. So what does that mean by recidivism? Like, that means I'm less likely to get rearrested or reconvicted and cause more damage in like society. Like, why would we not want to educate people and create opportunities for individuals? Like, it just makes no sense to me. I hear a lot of people just demonize it. Like, they don't deserve education. Well, I think in the U.S., education actually should be a fundamental right. And education can really help people as they come home and give them opportunity. And also, and that's just, education is just a big part of it. But like substance abuse programs, like people that have addiction issues, they should be helped and treated with compassion. You know, it's why do we just demonize them and not give them help? And then you wonder why someone goes and breaks into a house or commits a violent act to get more drugs. Well, you never helped them with, you could have given them $10,000 to help them with their addiction issues and do better and maybe get employed. But no, we'll spend millions of dollars after they commit a crime and harm the community and themselves and their families, and that'll cost us millions of dollars. I like the $10,000 solution personally, not just from an ethical standpoint, but from a fiscal one. It is cheaper to rehabilitate individuals than it is to incarcerate them. On average, it costs anywhere from $30,000 to $60,000 to incarcerate individuals. When you have people that are older or have more serious medical conditions, that can cost upwards of $100,000 a year. Imagine that. A prisoner that is in their like 70s, that is like got dementia or liver failure or whatever, the public is paying that. Like they're not on Medicaid in the system. The state is paying for their health care. When we could have just helped this individual 20 years ago, they wouldn't even done what they did, more likely than not. So I think we need to really realize that there is a moral and simultaneously fiscal reason to support more rehabilitative health. And that's a part of the dramatic reformation camp. It's not that we just abolish prisons altogether. We need to inject heavily rehabilitative programming into the system. But we still have to have an element of incapacitation. Even for someone like myself, I don't think I deserve, nor did the state decide that I was so incorrigible that I could never be released, but I needed a time out. So we have to find more ways to offer programs to help people out.
Aaron, that's all the time we have for today, but thank you so much for speaking with me and sharing your story.
Yeah, you're welcome, Kelly. I was honored to be a guest on the show. It's been great talking with you about these issues. And I just hope other individuals listen to this podcast and this radio program to really learn more about the system and educate themselves so they can be a part of the solution.
And thank you for listening to WBOI Presents In Session.
You can find more episodes of WBOI Presents In Session at WBOI.org, and while you're there, you can find the very latest from the WBOI news team and stay up to date on content we produce year-round. Our theme music is by Noah Campodonico. Our web producer is Loyal Vandenberg. This episode was produced with help from WBOI production assistant Steve Mullaney. Our production assistants are Monica Blankenship, Makai Bowers, Steve Mullaney, Kyle Norbeck, Diamond Thomas, Michaela Veltum, and Sydney Wagner. Until next time, thank you for listening. From WBOI Fort Wayne.